Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Good morning and welcome to our annual rules hearing, which was held annually in February. The record may show that notice of the rules hearing was published in the State Bar newsletter and also posted on our webpage. This is an informal procedure. We'll simply go through the proposals in order. And to save time, we usually ask the opponent to speak first, which then tells the proponent if there's anything to rebut. And if there's any input from opponents, then we go to the proponents. And just come forward and if you wish to speak and use the podium. With that, rule number one is an amendment to SDCL 15628C. It's proposed by Mr. Clint Sargent, a member of the bar. Is there anybody who opposes this? Seeing none, is there anybody that would like to speak on its behalf? Mr. Sargent.
No, Your Honor.
You're just here for questions?
Any questions that the court may have,
yeah. I'll have. Any questions from the bench from Mr. Sargent? If not, thank you for coming, sir. I should note, too, for the record, that we did get written comments on some of the proposals, and those have been distributed to the court. All right. Proposal number two would amend SDCL 15245, as would Proposal 17 is, in essence, the same. It amends another provision by adding a definition of news media. Anybody wish to speak in opposition to this? Anybody wish to speak on behalf of it? Ms. Starkiapis. I failed to note this is proposed by the State Court Administrator.
Correct, Your Honor. I don't know that I have a lengthy presentation, but all this amendment would do would add the definition of news media to our media rules for both trial court proceedings as well as Supreme Court proceedings. It's consistent with other statutes in the law as well. So the legislature has basically approved this language.
Okay. Any questions from the bench? No? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to speak on proposals number 10 and 17? If not, proposals 3 through 16 are proposed by the Board of Bar Examiners. Does anybody wish to speak in opposition to any of these? If not, does anybody wish to speak on behalf of them?
I'm just here for questions, Your Honor. Our chair is in Hawaii, so I got sent here.
You got to go to Pier and she got to go to Hawaii.
I got a report from Sherry Anderson, though, that it is raining in Hawaii, so So if there are no questions, otherwise I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Heeb, member of the Board of Bar Examiners from the bench? If not,
well, there was one question about now. Is that in here where we're dealing with you have to have a JD in order to be admitted? Maybe you could explain why we're doing that.
I can try, Your Honor. I think the consensus of the board was that given the narrow nature of an LLM, you know, we've always required that you graduate from an accredited law school, which gives you a broad base of legal knowledge, at least theoretically, if you learn and pay attention and pass. What this would allow, if you didn't require graduation with a JD degree from an accredited law school, would be for someone to attend a non-accredited law school of almost any type, almost anywhere, and then take a one-year LLM course in a very narrow area. It could be taxation. It could be almost anything. And then we would be admitting them to the bar and submitting to this court that they were qualified to practice in any area. And I think the board was uncomfortable with that. We are seeing that become a little bit more prevalent now. People getting degrees from foreign schools that aren't accredited. I don't know if I would go so far as to say correspondence courses yet, but I think they're out there. And we've also seen that frankly, the LLM programs, even at the most prestigious schools in this country, are not that hard to get into, at least relative to their law schools. You know, you can get an LLM from some fairly prestigious places, and you're limiting yourself to a very narrow area to get that. And we don't know that necessarily indicates a competence to practice.
Are other state bars doing something like this?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, but I could certainly get the answer to that. We could conduct a survey, maybe. Sherry Anderson, I know from time to time, gets emails from other bars asking, what are you doing? What are your requirements? I could ask her if she could maybe send out an email or do some sort of a survey to find out whether this requirement exists in other jurisdictions. Is that what you're asking?
It would be interesting to know, because I just it seems like a good idea, but I worry about the consequences if we too narrowly define the requirements for admission. And I suppose this now, there used to be an LLB degree that lawyers got. I understand that's been converted now. Everybody who had an LLB automatically has a JD, or do you know about
that? I don't know. I looked up the terms because I didn't want to stand in front of you and have somebody ask me what is an LLM. And the way Blacks defines it is an LLB is a bachelor's, an LLM is a master's. And I couldn't really get my head around that because I thought what I had was a JD. So I wasn't really sure where that fit. What I do know from looking into it is that, you know, an LLM is generally confined to a very narrow area of the law, and you're receiving an LLM in tax or some narrow area. And in order to get into an LLM course, most of those schools don't require a JD from an accredited school. They just require a JD of some kind. So what we've had happen, and we haven't, I don't think we've turned anybody down, but I know there have been some inquiries of late where people say, look, I'm thinking about moving to your state, or I'm thinking about applying for admission. I don't have a JD from an accredited law school. I've got it from a foreign school or someplace that isn't accredited, but I'm thinking about getting an LLM, and would that qualify me? And we looked at our rule and said, you know, that's a good question. We don't know. What should we do? And this is what we proposed. But to answer your question, Your Honor, I will try to get a survey to the extent we can and find out what the other jurisdictions do with respect to that.
Other questions from the bench?
But the LLB, and it used to be that when you graduated from an accredited law school, you didn't get a JD, you got an LLB. The JD, I think, is something that's come by in the last 3 or 4 decades. So we're not eliminating lawyers who still have an LLB who are admitted to in other states, are we? I mean,
oh, no. No, if you have graduated from an accredited law school in a 3-year course of study or a course of study that would get you the equivalent of either the LLB or the JD, and I think that's the misnomer.
Is that language in there? I mean, I didn't see it. Should we have JD or equivalent in there?
Sure. I'll bring that up, too. Because I think that's the misnomer. I think that people view an LLM as being somehow on a higher plane than an LLB. And I suppose it is in the hierarchy, but in terms of what we're looking for, which is the broad-based knowledge that would allow you to hold yourself out as somebody who can represent a client in an area, we're not sure that it really gets you there. So,
any other questions for Mr. Heap? If not, thank you for coming, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see. The next one would be proposal number 18. It's proposed by Mr. Dean Nacer, a member of the bar. This would be a proposed adoption of a new rule relating to actual medical expenses incurred. Anybody wish to speak in opposition to this?
Good morning. morning, Honorable Chief Justice and Honorable Justices. My name is Naomi Cromwell. I joined in the opposition that was filed with the court in this matter by the Teason Law Office on behalf of my client, State Farm. I'll be very brief because I think that the written submissions were fairly thorough in this matter. But I just would reiterate that this rule number 18, I believe, would bring about some significant changes in how damages would be proved in civil litigation in this state. Again, just briefly, it would shift the burden to the defendant. It would set up a system by way of which affidavits could establish prima facie evidence of the reasonableness and the necessity of treatment, thereby shifting to the defendant the need to disprove that. This court has recognized on a number of occasions that affidavits are not generally considered competent evidence, some of the reasons being because they are not subject to cross-examination and because they are perhaps unintentionally subject to omissions and distortions of fact. I'd also note that this rule omits some important safeguards, I'll call them. There is no requirement that notice be given to the other side if an affidavit is going to be used. I think that in itself is very significant. For those reasons, Your Honor, we feel that the written submissions well explain that this rule would be significant in its changes, and we would urge the court to reject this particular rule.
You know, this looks awfully familiar. Haven't we dealt with something like this in the past? Wasn't this proposed in the past, or do you recall?
I don't recall that, Your Honor.
It certainly provoked some comment.
Yes, it did.
Any questions for Ms. Cromwell from the bench? If not, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Any other parties wish to speak on proposal number 18? Proposal number 19.
I apologize, Your Honor. Clint Sargent, I'm here at the request of Mr. Nacer to speak on behalf as a proponent of
okay.
the rule, if I may, and comment on the appointment.
Sure, come on up.
May it please the court. Your Honor, Mr. Nacer, knowing that I was coming today, asked if I would appear in his stead and comment in favor of his his rule. To address the opponent's comments, first of all, I'll kind of take them in reverse order. In receiving the written comments in opposition to this rule, I noticed that a common one is this complaint that there's no notice requirement within the rule. Several of our rules of civil procedure have no notice requirements written into them. We don't have a notice requirement or a deadline that you have to amend pleadings. We don't have a notice requirement or a deadline to which you have to submit an expert report or identify your experts. But these things are things that are commonly dealt with every day in the trial courts of South Dakota through scheduling orders. Whether it be by stipulation or even a contested scheduling order, it's common that these things are identified. And so what is a very common practice in South Dakota right now is in identifying your experts by adding just a few words to our common stipulations for scheduling order. It can be identify your experts or any affidavits under SDCL 1912-3.1. Now, the idea that this shifts the burden of proof is not necessarily true. What it is simply a rule of evidence that allows evidence that's often non-controversial evidence, non-disputed evidence, to come in without burdening all of the parties involved. It really promotes judicial efficiency. It doesn't waste the court's time by calling an unnecessary witness to say, yes, these were the medical bills that were charged at my clinic. Yes, I believe that they were necessary. And yes, I believe that they're reasonable. Because who these apply to are licensed healing practitioners who have ethical obligations not to provide unnecessary treatment. They have ethical obligations not to provide treatment and charge unreasonable fees for them. So this isn't the type of evidence that is open to exaggeration or omission or those types of things. It's simply sworn testimony that these bills were charged, that the provider is stating that they're reasonable and that they were necessary. Now, by saying that they're necessary, that just means that they're medically necessary. That doesn't necessarily mean that they were related to the litigation at hand. Clearly, the rule sets that out, that the issue of causation is not covered in any way by this rule. All of this does is does something very similar to what the court has done in the criminal law with the affidavits that are able to be provided by the prosecution as it relates to chemical analysis of blood samples or other types of evidence. In a criminal trial, unless the other or preliminary hearing, grand jury, all of those under SDCL 23-3-19.3, we allow an affidavit from a chemist to come in and be prima facie evidence that their findings are what they are. This rule simply mirrors that same thing for the same reasons that so often an expert who's tested a blood sample isn't going to have his testimony challenged. Now, if you get to the issue of extrapolation or those types of things, they may be challenged, like causation may be challenged. So Mr. Nacer's proposed rule is very akin to the criminal's rule and certainly would promote judicial efficiency for the courts. It would provide for relieving an unnecessarily burdensome hardship and inconvenience on our medical providers who never want to come to provide this testimony. And when they do so, it's an extreme cost to the parties that call them. So for all of those reasons, I believe that it certainly would improve the function of the courts of South Dakota.
You know, refresh my recollection. Has this proposed rule been vetted through any of the bar committees?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. To answer your previous question, there is a separate rule that deals with medical records in cases of $75,000 or less. Right. That deals with records that allow the opinions of doctors to come in via affidavit and so forth under that threshold. But then that gets into the causation and all those other types of issues. This is much more narrow.
Other questions for Mr. Sargent?
Mr. Sargent, what is the purpose for the last phrase where it's provided, however, that nothing contained herein shall permit the introduction of collateral sources or amounts paid, approved, or discounted to collateral sources? What's that dealing with?
It's simply to codify what this court has ruled in so many cases that collateral source evidence is not permitted to try to attack the reasonable value of services. Is it the Papke case where this court ruled that in fighting over what the reasonable value of services is, the defendant can't come in and say, well, while you were billed $100,000, Medicare only paid $25,000 for those and that other $75,000 was written off. And the defense can't offer that evidence in collateral source, Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance. This would simply just clarify within this rule that nothing in this rule would affect the court's prior rulings in that regard.
Other questions for Mr. Sargent? If not, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Is there anybody else that wishes to speak on proposal number 18? Sure. You came all the way from Aberdeen. You might as well get to do something.
Category of you don't have a dog in this fight, but since you're here, I do a lot of this work, and unlike Mr. Sargent, he and I are usually on the other side of the fence from each other. I do defense work, and I don't. I've read the rule. I think it's a good rule, in the sense that I think it's ridiculous to require somebody as a defense attorney to have to drag a doctor in to lay the foundation that you know darn well you're not going to object to anyway. I think in that sense, even as a defense attorney, I think it's ridiculous to do that.
From a practical standpoint, from my experience, I've never required anybody to do that in the trials that I've tried. And then usually what ends up happening is I'll tell them, I'll stipulate to yours if you'll stipulate to mine. And usually we have a deal. The concern that I have with this rule is just that. If we are going to allow the foundation to be laid by affidavit for the plaintiff, you no longer have the hammer as the defendant to say, okay, well, now what about mine? And what mine always relates to are the records. I've got prior records from doctors that person treated with years earlier that I think are relevant on their face to whether the pre-existing condition is what's causing the problem or not. If you think it's difficult to get a treating physician who's working on behalf of that patient to come to court, trying to track down some doctor that they saw 10 years earlier or 5 years earlier who may not even be in practice anymore to come in and simply say, that's a true and accurate copy of a record that I produced that's in that person's file, or even in a clinic that may be closed up with all the consolidation that we have now, it's getting harder and harder, frankly, to even find records custodians for these people. And I guess, I don't even know if this is appropriate, but I think the rule's a good rule. I would simply add to it that, you know, you could do the same thing with an affidavit from a records custodian with respect to medical records of any kind. You're not saying that they are anything other than you're laying the foundation through an affidavit. And I guess personally, I don't think we try enough lawsuits, and I think the biggest reason we don't is because of these things that keep us from doing it. And that's always been my hammer is, you know, when we get into that battle about foundation, I always say, well, if you'll stipulate to mine, I'll stipulate to yours. And if they won't, well, then the threat is there that, well, then all bets are off and you're going to have to drag your doctors in if I'm going to have to drag mine in. And usually that ends up, you know, working itself out because of that. And that's the only practical significance or the only practical concern that I have about the rule. In fact, I had that fight with Tex Hoy outside of Justice Severson's courtroom when he was on the trial bench, and he had to tell us both to settle down about what foundation meant. But I mean, that's always the battle, and I'm concerned that this may tip the scale. And I like the rule. I think it's a good one. I just wish it went even further.
Do you want a reciprocal?
Yeah, with respect to records. You know, that's always the issue. And as Mr. Sargent pointed out, there are times the plaintiff wants records in, and I don't see the point behind requiring, if you're going to play that game, requiring people to bring doctors in to say this is or a custodian, that this is a true and accurate copy. I'm not saying you can't object to it. If you think it's not an accurate copy, I mean, folks, we all get this stuff ahead of time. We know what's coming into evidence. There isn't a trial judge in the state that doesn't say pre-mark your exhibits and exchange them. Now, if I'm looking at a document that I think's been doctored, well, then that can be my job to go get that deposition taken or to subpoena that witness to come to court and say, this is a fake. You know, this isn't legit. But we all know that the majority of the time, almost 100% of the time, we know what we're looking at. And if we could simplify that on both ends, I think it would be a huge service to those of us who try cases.
Because you could do the same thing, maybe not as easily, with requests to admit, too, couldn't you? I mean, because if you refuse to admit something and it has to be proved and you later don't prevail, you're going to pay for that. It's not quite as direct, but still that would accomplish it too.
If you would make that truly mandatory, I think that would be definitely a bigger hammer. Absolutely. Absolutely. But there are some cases, Your Honor, where I'll submit it's almost impossible to lay that foundation when you've got a clinic that's been bought up by Sanford or Avera. Those doctors have gone in-house, and you can't find anybody that can tell you where that record came from sometimes. And that may be your problem, you know, if somebody contests it, the validity of it. But I guess I'm throwing that out there. That's my concern, is that two-way street that we currently have that generally allows for that exchange where you detente, you know, okay, fine. I'll stipulate to yours, you stipulate to mine, and now we can go to trial.
It would have been nice if we could have got it through one of the bar committees and maybe had it hammered out as an agreement between both defense and plaintiff bar. Maybe that's not possible. Maybe I'm just being too idealistic. But
I maybe you are. I you know, In all fairness, I do defense work. I'm probably going to get crucified by, you know, the friends of mine that do it, and I happen to be sitting here today, but I think it's ridiculous to require somebody who's trying a plaintiff's case to lay the foundation for their medical records just out of a sense of, I'm going to make this so expensive and so difficult for you that you're not going to be able to get this case to trial, and I'm going to bank on that. Now, by the same token, I don't like it very much when a plaintiff's attorney looks at me and says, I'm going to make you come in and lay foundation for records that they know darn well came out of that file, and now I've got to haul somebody in to do it. So it cuts both ways. I've never done it, and hope I never have to.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Heeb?
Thank you.
Mr. Sargent, what do you think about Mr. Heeb's pitch for reciprocity?
Your Honor, I would have no objection to reciprocity. I don't think that this rule addresses medical records. This is simply talking about medical bills. So there usually isn't a reciprocal defense bill that they want to put in. But as far as medical records, you know, I think Justice Konenkamp had a great suggestion with request for admissions. But I echo, you know, what Mr. Heeb says. If we want to have another rule that says that you can put in essence, business records with an affidavit, I know that there are several states that have that, and maybe we've been behind the curve in adopting that. I mean, maybe that would be a very good thing to have for all cases, not just personal injury cases, but that we, in this day and age, accept that when we get these business records, if we get an affidavit of authentication, then that's all we need, and that would apply to medical records just like any other business record.
Okay.
What is your thought on, is this something that maybe some BART committee or committee should look at to get the exact language and what's in this prior to our dealing with it as a rule?
I echo what Jack says, Your Honor. I've been on some of those BART committees, and it splits pretty much down the line of what people normally do to get the plaintiff and defense to come together, even on stuff that maybe makes sense. Overall, it is a very difficult thing to do, and I think that's why we're here today asking the court to make a decision that is really just good common sense for judicial efficiency, and maybe make the children all act appropriately.
On that cheery note, any other questions for Mr. Sargent? If not, thank you for coming back up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Cromwell, do you wish to add anything to your presentation?
No, thank you.
Okay. Does anybody else want to speak on this rule? All right. Then we would go to rule proposal number 19, which would amend 23A 44 5.1 parent 4. And this is proposed by the Honorable Bruce Anderson. Anybody want to speak in opposition to this? Anybody want to speak on behalf of it?
Your Honor, if I may, I don't mean to monopolize
the time. Well, it justifies you driving in from Sioux Falls.
Yes. I don't know. I thought that this issue, or the court had been notified about this. I know that Brad Schreiber had initially intended to be here on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, myself as well. There has been some ongoing discussion with Judge Anderson between the States Attorneys Association, Criminal Defense Association, and trying to maybe hammer out this language so that everybody can be on the same page. I just wanted to make sure that the court was aware of
that. We are aware of that. The clerk was advised by Mr. Schreiber of that fact, but this is still the time and place for anybody to put their two cents in.
Certainly.
And we will obviously consider what further work product they want to present to us, but I'm just asking here and now, does anybody want to say anything in addition to that?
I have nothing additional.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sargent. All right. This then would complete the proposed rules. This is the last chance for anybody to comment on any of the rules. There being none, the court will be in recess and will take these proposals under advisement. We are in recess.